Live from the Ghost Hunter Store, brought to you by the Shadowlands, South Jersey Ghost Research, and the Ghost Hunter Store. Here's some paranormal straight talk with your hosts, Dave Giuliano and Marty Haynes.
Welcome to the show. We had some technical difficulties, so this is going to be a podcast only. We're having problems with the server again. We have a guest this week. We've been going. Our producer Taryn has been on the run, getting a lot of guests every week now, so it's been a regular thing. Carolyn Doherty, right? I said that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Hi, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Great.
Did we meet at Eastern or Burlington County Prison?
We met a couple years ago, maybe a few years ago now. I went down there with my husband and we went through the Burlington County Museum and the prison there and had a really good time.
I met you in the dark and I just remember that. I remember in the
I went to the Ghost Hunter store too, so we chatted a couple times. So
2 years ago, after my heart attack, all my half my memories are gone. So from the open heart surgery,
So
one of the bad side effects with the medicine and everything else. But I have Taryn's here with us.
Hello,
Keith and
Hi,
Wendy.
Hi.
They're going to be our new co-hosts because no one wants to listen to me talk all the time because I don't give the guests much time to talk, and then it winds up being like
the Dave show,
and Carolyn happened to be on the line during the show, so. We got your book too, The Creepy Corners: Searching for Truth in Paranormal Claims, and we also your website too is Carolyn's Creepy Corner too. Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved in the paranormal? I guess it's like the generic question that I hate to answer all the time, but everyone has to ask. So what got you started in all this?
I guess, like I said in the book, I always had an interest. It was sparked probably by my grandmother. She had told me when I was very young her own experience where she believed she saw the spirit of her father shortly after he passed away. So before that, you know, I saw all the monster movies and I kind of equated ghosts along with vampires and werewolves and that type of thing. And then that was the first day it hit me that they were once people. And I think that going on from there is where I started getting every book that I could, watching ghost movies, and just being interested from then on.
So it started early for you. It's kind of was it your grandmother on your mother's side?
My father's.
Oh, and your father's. Wow. Did he ever experience stuff?
Not anything that he has ever told me. She told me shortly after her father passed away, she went in there, and she was a young woman at the time. She went into the room where he was laid out and saw a glowing, what she described as a glowing mist floating above him.
Hmm, that's interesting.
And at the time, I'm pretty sure, you know, this was probably in the 30s. So I'm not sure if the house at that point did have electricity because it was a more rural area. So it was a very long time ago. But that's what she thought. It was his spirit.
And so I only asked because I noticed that through years of just talking to people that it's hereditary or heredity plays a little bit into if you have, like, psychic abilities. So I was wondering if it... And it usually travels down the female side of the family easier than the male side.
I don't know if he has, but if he did, he's never told me.
That's what... You know, some people don't talk about that, so that's not unusual either. My wife's 96-year-old grandmother didn't tell us till she was 94 that she'd been seeing stuff all her life in the house that we live in now, which is across from a cemetery, so I see stuff every day. But
now, Carolyn, this is Keith. I was reading through your blogs,
online, and I mean, I read the last two, mm-hmm. the one about the orbs, and then the skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the skeptic one I liked the most. You know, it was the most recent also, but that I guess you more come from like a scientific, you know, background. You need to see, you know, real hard evidence. I guess it was kind of saying.
Well, I started out as a true believer. I just took claims at face value. And when I actually started to become more involved in actively investigating and researching some information that could explain some claims, the more I did that, the more I started asking, okay, are we doing this right? Or am I doing this right? And I really, I'm one of those people that I feel if you're going into people's homes, if you're calling yourself an investigator and you're using sciencey terms like research and data and evidence and protocols and that type of thing, there's a little responsibility behind it, and I really don't want to mislead anybody. So I want to make sure that I have something to back up evidence or a claim if I tell somebody, yeah, I think this is X, Y, Z.
Yeah, I read that you were saying about, like, there were one of the shows that you have watched, you don't watch many, but, you know, the show that you were watching had all the historical facts, like, completely incorrect.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, that's a turnoff.
And I'm not, you know, and I don't want to bash the show, that's why I didn't name it, but, yeah, I was very disappointed because there was a show that profiled a historical location in my area, and, you know, within the first 5 minutes, they had the historical facts wrong. And so that, to me, it was kind of like, well, how credible is the rest of your investigation skills? I mean, do you know how to use your equipment? Do you know what things can affect your equipment in the environment or what glitches or what have you? How credible are you at analyzing any of the data that you collect if you can't even get basic historical facts that anyone can look up right? So yeah, that was kind of my, that was the point of that particular blog was, I think I called that one just the facts meal.
I like the points there, but you guys, Wendy and Keith, they just went through the training, and so did Taryn. I kind of, sometimes I don't give out directions to places. I'll just tell you we're meeting here. And mm-hmm. then they'll, sometimes it's inevitable. Someone will ask, like, well, what's the address? And I'm like, if you can't find the address for, like, this diner or wherever we're meeting at, or then you're never going to find a ghost if you can't look up the directions for a building that's, you know,
right.
brick and mortar solid thing. I mean, so I understand where you're coming from. And I feel sorry for the people that are the ones that walk around and honest to God believe that they are following some sort of scientific method to the T, and they're purely scientific, because the scientific method can't be taken out into the field like that without controls and everything. And it's an impossible task inside a private house and in most historical locations.
And I totally 100% agree with that. And I think one of the points I wanted to make, or I hope I made on the Skeptic article, was that a lot of people in the field and in the general population as well misinterpret the term skeptic. They confuse it with the term cynic. And a cynic dismisses everything just off hat. You know, I don't care what you put in front of them, they're not going to believe you. They're not going to accept the claim.
Whereas Joe Nickel.
A skeptic, you know, in the true scientific sense, a skeptic test the validity of claims through methodologies, through systematic methodology. And if the evidence supports it, it's accepted. If it doesn't, it's dismissed. But that doesn't mean it's dismissed forever. For example, if new evidence comes in or new information comes in, they will reassess that, and then maybe later on they will accept it.
I firmly agree. I've seen stuff and experienced stuff since I was 3 years old. And people are shocked when they see that, like, I don't just take everything on face value. And some things can't be explained. There's just really no explanation for some things. We don't know how the EVPs work. We don't know the process of how they get. There's theories. We have tons of theories. Mm-hmm. Proof on how the stuff actually happens, well, that's what we're lacking. You know, so it's like it's not science shouldn't even be really used in in conjunction.
Yeah, well, I will. Hi, Carolyn. It's Taryn.
Hi.
One show that came out no longer on, and I know you don't want to name it, but I'll say it. I'm not saying that was the show you were talking about, but Ghost Lab. You know, they tried to go out to every single place with these big, huge, everything was scientific and trying to do this and this and that, but then was turning around. And now I'm watching it, and I know there was, at one point, they were at a historical place, and one of the doorbell was going off. And they said, oh, well, all the electric's out. So they went halfway up to where the bell is on this top plank, and all they did was look at it, and they're like, oh, no, that couldn't be going off. And I'm like, you didn't even, like...
That was the last episode I watched, actually.
Yeah. Did you see that?
Yes, I remember.
And a lot of people mistake technology for scientific. They think if they parade a whole array of gear and technology, that makes them scientific.
Right.
And it really isn't unless you apply methodology behind it. And I think that's where a lot of criticism comes from skeptics, because, you know, it's okay to have all this equipment, but if you don't know how to use it and you don't know how to analyze the data and you're not really, you know, you're not giving true information, if you're giving misinformation based on false positives, that's not scientific.
That's
where I think that's where some of the problem is, where there's a communication disconnect between some people who claim they're science-based and then truly science-based people.
Well, one of the things I do when I give either my trainings for my new investigators or the classes I give from the store, every once in a while you get people who come just because they're being drug along, you know, with other groups. And because I think... my ego may be talking here, but
you're the paranormal.
Yeah, I'm the paranormal, exactly. But I've always wanted to know how things work. I'm too inquisitive. So that's, I find that people that have been doing this for years and years and years, I still come across people using something that to me is a basic piece of equipment totally incorrectly, or have no idea how it really functions. And that's why they don't even use some of the stuff. And every single class I get, I mean, it's basic things that they've seen on TV that they'll say, well, this is how this works. And it's like, no, it's not. I mean, you can go on Google. Just Google it. You'll learn more than you're going to learn from watching that show.
Watch on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, there's more information out there that way. But some people just, it's amazing. Because going out...
Right, and I started out that way, and I remember one of our first conversations was several years ago now, where after a certain TV show, I wanted a K2 meter. And you politely tried to tell me over the phone, there are better meters out there. And I was one of those people, it's like, well, I saw it on TV, and these guys are great, and I want my K2 meter. And then, you know, I eventually was pointed to various articles of why that's not the best EMF detector, and et cetera. And so I eventually learned from, you know, actively learning from other people who knew what they were doing and not just watching TV. And I think that's why, in truth, a lot of people think I criticize a lot of teams or methods and that type of thing. But I do so because I used to make those same mistakes.
Right, people don't understand corrective criticism.
I made them and I learned from them.
That's the same thing with me. I mean, I learned by, I mean, it's embarrassing. But, like, not everyone's willing to admit that, like, you know, I was telling people how even, like, a basic passive... The reason why I get on my trainees, they're looking at me now, about the passive infrared motion sensor is because I was teaching people how to use it wrong for, like, 8 or 9 years before I realized that I had misunderstood how it was working. So that's why I'm such, like, a, you know, strict on you guys kind of know how this works, because it was something that, like, I couldn't believe that, like, I just didn't understand the basics of it, and once I did, it was like, oh my God, how could I have thought? It was like this light bulb went off over my head, like, damn, I was really stupid. But
I admire people in the field who can admit that. A lot of the people that I've learned from have openly admitted, hey, we all started out someplace and we all, you know, made these mistakes along the way. And I have a lot more respect for people who can say, you know, I made these same mistakes than somebody who just kind of preaches down to people or criticizes people.
I think you learn.
You know, I think a lot more can be done with, you know, just admitting.
Well, that's the thing, too, is like before we joined SJGR, we were watching a lot of the shows. And then once we joined, we realized, you know, what the equipment was and how it worked and that, you know, just because you got a certain reading or a certain, you know, something that, you know, just because you're on TV and it makes for a good show doesn't necessarily mean that you actually got something.
Well, I will say...
Exactly.
I will say that before I joined and went through my training and everything, I have every season of Ghost Hunters on DVD and I'd watch it religiously, swore by them. And then I joined and I'm telling you, when I found out things that I know now, I felt like I just found out Santa Claus didn't exist anymore.
Jay, if you're listening out there, I'd just like to say, buddy, I didn't know she was going to say that. You know, I
still love them. I still love them.
All right.
But it's TV.
But the thing is, especially watching this season of that show, it's hard because now we know so much more than
right.
we did. And Caroline, you said you watched all those shows when you first started. And that's how mm-hmm. I was. I could not see enough of them. And now watching them, like especially this season, they're getting maybe some really credible evidence, but they don't even know what to do with it now because they've been doing it so screwed up for so long. It seems
and I try not to attack the actual people. I mean, I've met them, I've investigated.
TV's TV.
Investigating, right. So I'm not attacking the actual people, but I wish people would approach these shows more as the entertainment they are and not as a portrayal as valid investigating.
Right. The way I always, I think one of the things I give people in the class, I tell them that, like, if you think the people, like, in Survivor are really stranded on the island all alone, starving,
right.
you know, then you're naive and you deserve to be that way and think that everything you see on TV is real. I mean, I've worked
right.
with, I've done episodes of shows where I wind up putting my hand up over the camera, stopping, unplugging the mic, doing stuff because they were obviously trying to perpetrate like some not intentionally a fraud. They were trying to make entertaining TV. That's what they were trying to do. But I wasn't going to play along with that. They wanted me to make a meter make a certain sound, even though that's not reality how we use it. So I mean, I give the guys in the shows a lot of credit for doing that and putting up with that. But they're in the entertainment field now. The entertainment field is
yeah.
different than the ghost hunting or paranormal research field.
And the only criticism that I have is that sometimes it is portrayed in a way that I think it does mislead viewers. And again, that's why I always tell people I'm not knocking people who watch the shows and I'm not knocking, you know, the people who do the shows. I'm just saying, you know, please approach it from more of an entertainment thing than, quote, reality.
And
that's all I promote. But that's with any TV, like you said.
And I think they should put that disclaimer on those shows as well.
But it is kind of like, the other analogy I always use too is like watching This Old House with Bob
mm-hmm.
Vila out there going to put a new roof on, and in 30 minutes they've ripped out a window, put a new roof on, and a new bathtub in. You don't watch that in 30 minutes and then go tear your bathtub out and start doing it, put a new roof
on.
But
you know somebody out there is doing that. They
exactly.
think they can
right.
do it.
Right. There is somebody who's watching, and that's the problem.
Right.
Now, should they put a disclaimer saying, this actually took a week long of filming
right.
to get this down, we can get this down? No, because that's just stupid.
Right.
People should realize
yeah.
that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
but like, when they see even the shows, they've been at a location for 4 or 5 days filming to get down to 45 minutes worth
Once
of stuff.
Once in a while, that leaks out. They'll say, you can come back for another 2 weeks if you want to. And you're like, what? That wasn't just one night?
Right, but also,
yeah.
what the people that watch it and aren't trained and haven't been around, you know, they also know how to really use the equipment. They know how to protect themselves. They know how to do all that stuff. Whereas you get a group of teens, you know, whether it be the Jackass movies and they try to go out and jump off of a house with a shopping cart, or you get a bunch of kids that are watching and want to go to a cemetery and using a K2 the way they're seeing it mused on here, or we, you know, whatever the case may be. I mean, you're taking a chance, you know, so I think
right and And that's why, I mean, I did start my blog a couple years ago because I did notice that a lot of people were just watching these shows, and a lot of teams that I interacted with and I met and I investigated with were just watching these shows and taking them at gospel.
Right.
They weren't questioning anything. They weren't questioning how the technology works. And again, I was guilty of that myself. And then once I got in with some people who did have experience in, who were professional photographers, who were electrical engineers, audio engineers, psychologists, etc., who did explain certain things to me using their scientific expertise, all of a sudden, you know, oh, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the light bulb came on that, okay, you know, something else needs to be done. And that's why I started my blog, which eventually turned into the book, is because I wanted to provide more reliable resources out there. And I'm not saying I'm 100% right and you should take me at face value, but look at the resources that I provide and research it for yourself. Test the claims for yourself.
I think that you should always take information from everywhere, put it together, and then you form your own opinion instead of, you know, hey, I read this book and this is, you know, the facts, or I read this blog, or, you know, read this on Facebook and it's the truth. And I mean, you have to
read
it from everywhere and then, you know, formulate your own opinion.
Yeah, and Carolyn, I mean, I myself was the same way. Like, I was running around cemeteries and doing this and that and had no idea what I was doing when I started to train with South Jersey Ghost Research. I had no idea, and I looked at Dave and I'm like, I'm surprised I'm standing here right now after all of the things that, you know, I did totally wrong. You know, and I have to say that I think it's awesome that you take this approach to try to use it for, you know, a lot of people might say, oh, she's a skeptic, whatever, but I don't think that. I think that you're, you know, what you're writing about should be more out there to
people.
More
investigators with that attitude to question those things.
I kind of think a lot of people should just buy your book and read it.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Because it kind of, I agree with almost everything in there, I think. Just, because it hits the heart of issues that people don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's...
Yeah, I did want to do that too. I wanted, a lot of books that I've read, again, because, you know, I have a library full of books, but most of them were either, quote, true ghost stories or, quote, case studies by people who, again, were not really applying any science behind them and that type of thing. And I wanted to address not just the technology or not just, hey, these are things to do if you're a ghost hunter. I wanted to make people aware of other things out there, including there is a lot of fraud in the community, and I think that has to be addressed. I think there's a problem with what I coined para-profiteering, where some of these locations are manufacturing claims. They're manipulating the history of the site to get people in to pay a nice fee.
I know. Mm-hmm. I've been personally asked to, we have a local ghost tour here, and it's based off of my group's research over the past 14 years. It's a nice, like, two-hour walking tour. Mount Holly's got a lot of haunted places around. But I've been approached by businesses that have never reported anything at all, never had anything, and they just want to get on the ghost tour because of, it helps business. And they've even come out and said
that. Yeah, we've been asked by people to come in to tell so they could say their place was haunted.
And that's, you know, I've never, that's just some, I have ethics, I guess. I'm aware that's not as common as everyone would like to think in this field. Right.
You know, but not only that, it just takes, let's just say, you know, you're like, okay, whatever. But that just removes all validity in anything that you have done and anything that you believe in.
But you see, that's one of the things that I found refreshing in the book,
right,
too, was you're assuming that there's integrity throughout the field of,
right,
paranormal research.
Right.
And that just simply isn't the case.
Right.
There are other agendas. There's people who want to make money. There's people who are in it just for ego and what they consider fame. And that's why I just wanted to make people, especially those who are interested in entering the field or the community, to be aware of. Because I know I came into it kind of like with rose-colored glasses thinking, oh, yay, we're all looking for the same thing, and yay, everybody's honest, and no, it's not that way. So.
Yeah, see, but I guess because I've been doing it, especially around here, years ago, when I first started with South Jersey Ghost Research, there was only one other group in the whole state when we kind of formed, and that was more. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a research group. It was like a ghost kind of club, enthusiasts. So we were the only research group, and over 14 years, there's probably like 200 or 300 in the state. More than half, I probably trained someone in that group, and they left my group disgruntled and formed their own group. You know, it's not as bad as it used to be, but it's still not like one big happy family. Some people treat it like, you know, it's territorial. Yeah, it's my fire hydrant. Don't want to come near this.
Yep.
I peed on this whole area. You cannot come into this area. I mean, it's really, and it's ridiculous. I'd rather have more people come in, because the more people that come into the same location, the more pool of evidence you have to compare to. To me, again, that's just common sense, but...
But then again...
And again, that's why I'm glad you brought that up, because part of my problem with the place that was profiled on the TV show in this area, they only let a certain team come in. And, of course, coincidentally, that team's been on TV a couple times. But, you know, they don't let other teams in. And, okay, whatever happened to peer review? Whatever happened to trying to replicate the same results? Again, that's not investigating.
We've run into some issues with that, too. There's just places that we've been helping certain locations like Gabriel Davies Tavern and other places that are local to us. But we've been doing fundraisers for them. They were one of the first places to, like, let us in and investigate, and we did fundraisers for them. So we do every October we do a little thing. It winds up being one of their biggest fundraisers. So they don't want other people in. They like us. They don't. It's their choice not to allow people in. Mm-hmm. I can't change their mind, but I've found loopholes around it. Instead of letting other groups come in, we've now held events either through the store or through the group where anybody can come in, like a pay event as another fundraiser for them, so other people can get in there. And if it's for a good cause in a historical place, it's not doing it for sheer profiteering. I don't have a problem with that. It's the other places, like I could name one, Ralph. It's on the tip of my tongue, but it's that just want to rake in the bucks and. Until as much as they can, hoping this wave, they ride this whole wave out, you know?
Well, my problem with this one particular place is that the team presented some things that, for a place that's crying for revenue, and that was almost shut down because of state closures, they presented some things that could potentially scare people away, especially families who want to bring their kids to this location. And then when you review what that team presented, it was, anyone with any critical thinking skills could find an answer of why they were experiencing what they were experiencing. So they were kind of shooting themselves in the foot. You can't cry for revenue and then present something that's going to scare everybody away.
I think it falls to that old advertising premise that there is no bad, publicity. Where any publicity is good publicity as long as people know the name for
Lindsay
whatever reason.
Him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I
somehow
mean,
Lindsay Lohan.
Kind of locations, if it's a private place, that's their call. But if it's a public location on taxpayers' dollars, and you let one person in, you have to let the other person in, especially if you're all paying taxes. So.
That's true, and that is something that. That happens everywhere. I mean, again, there's another place that pops in. It's actually a state-run facility that has one group nearby that's just, they monopolize it, but it's a monetary partnership because they've asked me through the store to get involved because they need a vendor for some of their events, and I've turned them down. I'm turning down quite a significant amount of sales I would make at their events, but I don't like the ethics that are involved.
Yeah.
And
to be clear, I mean, I support events that, especially at historical venues, because as a member of a historical society, and I've volunteered for historical societies in the past, I support anything that can help maintain a historical site and keep it running. So I want to make sure that people don't think, I'm against these kind of events, because I'm not. I I fully support them. I just want them to be done, hopefully, in a more responsible manner.
Do you, Carolyn, do you currently, like, would you go out to places with groups and kind of, or have you ever, and just kind of analyzed what they do and sat in the back, and then you would base some of your writings off of that?
Yes. Before, I was part of my group. Right now I'm kind of a loner, but before I was doing it, I didn't have an agenda of, gee, I'm going to see what these guys are doing. I was there, honestly, because I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn how to do this. I wanted to do it for myself. I wanted to be part of a good team, a credible team. And I wanted to go and investigate as many locations and different types of locations as I could. So it wasn't like I had this agenda of, what are these people doing wrong so I can write a book and criticize it. That's not what I was doing. And certainly when I was investigating with my team, I didn't have that agenda. But I was taking notes because I wanted to know how to do it right. Again, right, I know that's a subjective term, but do it that's in the client's best interest. These people are inviting us into their space, whether it's their home or their private business or whatever, and so I wanted to do it in the most responsible way that best served the client.
Right. And would you say that you are sensitive? Like, have you had personal experiences and all that stuff?
I don't know if I'm any more sensitive to anybody else. That's why I kind of distinguish beliefs from facts. I believe I've had experiences. I believe I've had some maybe possible psychic things going on. But because I have nothing objective to back it up, I'm not comfortable saying that, yes, I'm not asserting it as a fact. But do I have beliefs? Absolutely.
Yeah, Your book is very refreshing. It's very different. I love it. I told you it's awesome.
The reason I asked is
I don't know if you're familiar with Mark Nesbitt, who's in
in Gettysburg. Yep.
Yes. Where he himself, he says he is like a brick wall when it comes to having any experiences or anything. But
yeah,
he has all these. Writes all these books because he actually follows a certain group around and just documents their investigation, documents like the experiences that they have and their claims. You know, I think that's more where I was saying, like, I didn't know if that's what kind of the same thing, but.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, like I said, I left my group, I think last March. So I've been kind of going solo right now. I am, in talks with people of possibly doing a follow-up to Creepy Corners and investigating with people and, again, taking notes of what they're doing, assessing what I think works or what they're doing right and might help other teams to do or follow or adapt to whatever works for them. So I have been talking to different people and hopefully involve some traveling on my part, but yes, I would like to follow teams that I think that are doing it. I don't want to say right because that says that's a subjective term, but that I think are doing it in a productive way.
Well, we are having interviews December 10th.
Very politically correct. New Jersey's really nice.
Yes, and we would love for you to come and join us.
Well, I wish you guys were closer.
Maybe South Jersey does research. Oh.
I'd be at that Buccaneers ball if you guys were closer and you weren't holding it in December. But I would love to come down sometime when the weather is, good.
That'd be great.
And follow you guys around and ask questions because I'm still learning. That's the other thing. Just because I wrote a book, just because I've been on the radio a few times, I don't know everything. I'm still learning, and I can't possibly say I know for sure there's ghosts or I know for sure there aren't ghosts. That's why I'm still looking. That's why I'm still learning from people.
I'm going to stun everybody in the room here and say that I don't know everything either.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm still learning, too. There are no experts in this field. There never will be. Everyone is always learning. That's why the beauty of, like... our team dynamics, we always have new people coming in, and some people, like, I don't look, I mean, I mess around with the new people. You have to do the hazing and stuff, but, you know, I learn stuff from the new people, that because they're looking at it from, everybody's got their own unique perspective. Mm-hmm. I love when I figure something out because I'm looking at it through their eyes, and I've been missing it the whole time. It's always like, it's a real cool feeling to learn something new.
Yeah, I was going to say, how boring would life be if you knew everything that you already had to know and that was that?
Yeah, if you stop learning, you're pretty well done.
Oh, absolutely.
I like your book list, too, in the back, recommended reading.
Yes.
Yeah, there's that Ghost Research 101 by Dave Giuliano.
Yeah.
The guy's a real ass, but I mean, he's a good book.
It's also been sitting on my blog for a couple years, so.
Got tight on his head.
I'm actually working on a follow-up right now. I have to update it with all the new stuff.
Carolyn.
Oh, great.
Before we run too short on time, I did want to ask you about the orb situation.
Oh, dear.
We seem to be running into the same issues. You know, people still bringing up the orbs as valid evidence. Should it be? Shouldn't it be? And I really liked your blog article about that. That was great.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, here's my thing about orbs. You know, we have wonderful researchers like Kenny Biddle, who wrote Orbs or Dust, Practical Guide to False Positives. We have the Midnight Walkers Society, who did a false positive study. And the great thing about these people is they not only did the study and showed the results of what orbs are in photographs, they've explained the process, but they also tell you how to do your own experiments for yourself, so you can replicate and duplicate, see the results for yourself. And I give kudos for people who do that. It's easy to say, no, it's dust, and just leave it at that. But these guys actually went in and they put the effort out to provide a resource for people to, you know, refer back to.
Yeah, we have something on our SJR page that we did years ago. It's all a comparison of everything we thought we could get airborne, whether it was dust, pollen, or whatever. We took pictures of smoke, everything, and showed people.
Mold and breath mist, all sorts of things. Even in high humidity, you may not see it, but your camera sure does. Well, and that's what people fail to understand. And, you know, and what drives me, kind of my big pet peeve about orbs, is that you always hear people say, well, there's that 1% that's paranormal. I would really love to know the secret database of every orb picture ever taken and how they came to this conclusion, because I don't know about it. And again, until we have some sort of device that can conclusively distinguish a spirit orb from every other known cause that Sony manufacturer has told us about, professional photographers, professional videographers have explained, until there's that distinguishing feature, right now I'm going to go with the mountain of evidence that it's airborne particles.
I think there is a chance that they exist.
Well, there's a chance.
But I agree with you that there is no way of telling the difference. Just like you said, you can't tell by looking at a photo or a video clip whether that's an orb or airborne debris or anything. And until there's a method to 100%
determine
that, then it needs the argument just needs to be put to rest. And
right,
you know.
And that's why I never say never. But if you find a method that can prove it, then yay, I'll be the first person to applaud it. But the other thing is that I want people to be aware of, because we often hear people that I saw it with the naked eye. I didn't catch it on film. But we also have to look at environmental factors that can also cause little balls of light floating around. And, you know, again, you can't really call something paranormal as long as there's these other factors and explanations.
And somebody else had said to me, too, you know, what if it is, you know, because energy has to go somewhere. So they're saying, like, what if it's, you know, your own personal energy or somebody else's personal energy, like actually just, like getting out there and, you know. But I was like, well, if we take that, then then all it does is going to lead to still everything else.
Still can't yeah. prove it.
That's what I mean. Ultimately, we're just left with working theories.
Right.
I mean, until I always tell people when I do my lectures and stuff, I'm not going to try to sit here and explain, talk to you and prove ghosts exist. Because no one can, and I don't think in my lifetime no one will be able to.
Well,
unless
we
can get one in, if we get one in a little jar.
Well, I was going to say, we get it set up at like a facility, and I can die for a couple seconds, and then I'll say an EVP on your thing, and I can let you know what happens, and I'll come back, and we can do that.
Well, that's the thing. When I had my open heart surgery, I was dead. I mean, it was a machine pumping my blood. My heart was stopped for 6 hours. And when I came to, I was so disappointed that there was like nothing. You know, I didn't contact anybody. No one saw me. I don't remember anything. It's like, come on.
They have done studies on that, though. They've done out-of-body experiences where the person, for surgical reasons, for medical reasons, their bodies have been brought to a stop. Cold, heart stopped, earplugs in so they can't hear anything that's going on. Tape over their eyes so they can't see what's going on. Yet when they come back, they're able to recount the music that was being played,
in conversations,
what the people that were in the room looked like, to find details, what was being done to them. It's impossible for them to have known that. So how do you explain that?
Right.
And, I mean, I haven't seen the studies that are scientifically done. I've heard a lot of, anecdotal stories, so I mean, I'm not 100% sold either way. I do know there are people who are doing these kind of experiments, and it's been so far inconclusive. I mean, I have a bias towards believing it just because my mother went through it. I try to distinguish belief from fact. Do I want it to be true? Absolutely. And Dave, I completely sympathize with you because I've had open heart surgery myself when I was in my 20s, and one minute I was asleep, the next minute, I had a tube down my throat, but it changed me in different ways. It made me appreciate what I have now.
Do you really bring a notebook and a pencil on your investigations?
Oh yeah.
I do.
Really?
You know why? Here's why. Because we know from psychological studies, and if you talk to police officers, eyewitness and our memory just is not reliable. Our memory is extremely bendable. We often, even after a few hours, we fill in the blanks. Our brain fills in the blanks that we don't quite remember. And so it's not a reliable So for example, if I'm in a library and at 8:05 I hear some sort of sound, I'm going to write it down where I am and what kind of sound it is so I can check all the video later and cross-reference and see what was going on at that time, because it's very easy to get sequence of events messed up. And you know, I do that just for a reliable gathering of data.
I was just being really facetious there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But it was a very, very good answer. That's why I wanted to continue, because you were making a very valid point after I was just kidding. But because I was saying, like, I use digital recorders instead of writing everything down, because if I wrote stuff down, I wouldn't be able to read my own handwriting after the case. So it would be pointless. But it's,
and that's why, too, a lot of people rely on video. Their primary source of video or function for video is they want to catch a ghost. They want to catch a full-body manifestation. And I try to drum into people, no, the best use for your video is for cross-reference.
Exactly.
You know, if you find a picture, if you take a picture and you don't know exactly what that weird little light is, first of all, you should be taking control and comparison shots, but that's beside the point. You can go and check your video. EVP especially, I can't drum it into people enough, please videotape your EVP sessions, because you would be so surprised how you think people are not whispering or they're not shifting, and then you look back on the video where you've got that sudden growl and it's a person.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people, yeah, and that's just, again, it's it's a lack of understanding of the tool and looking at it, or the piece of equipment and looking at it with tunnel vision, seeing mm-hmm. how it was just used one way on a show or one way by someone who in a group that they learn from, and not just taking it out of the box. I mean, there's so many other uses, and filming the events that's even when nothing seems to be happening. I love just to film everything because you never know what's going to happen at any given time.
I mean, the hard part too is I'm sorry, Carolyn. A lot of times, like, we're in these older buildings, you know, the floors are so small, so thin, the walls are so thin. You know, so sometimes when another investigator's in another room talking, you're picking them up, and like you're saying, I mean, if you have other evidence to show, hey, you know, that was somebody on the other side of the wall, not, you know, something else.
Yeah.
Kind of gives you more credibility.
Oh, exactly. And also, if you don't take great control shots in well-lit conditions, it can also, you can review later where the vents are, where registers are, where pipes are, because we all know how sound can travel right up these things, and you may think you caught an EVP where, you know, it could have been something completely different or somebody from a whole different part of the building.
It's better to say that it was something, though, so you could prove that to, you know, to your client. Look what I got, even though it was your partner next to you.
Right, and that's where, again, sometimes people let their egos take over and they're not best serving the client, and, and that's a problem.
I always feel that, you know, if when you're doing a private house, you're in there for the people, not yourself.
Right. Exactly, so and I think a lot of people don't take it that way.
That's why I try to discourage people. If you're an enthusiast or you're if you're just in it for entertainment or even the scientific, if you're going to do a private house, make sure the people understand that that's all you're in it there for. If they're looking for some sort of answers or whatever, they need somebody else. They need a different group. I mean, we come out. There's many times that we go out to a house. I mean, we had about 200 cases that came in last year. Now, we didn't do 200 investigations, not even close. Because sometimes talking on the phone or driving out there and sitting on their couch and talking to them was enough to solve the issue they were having. And that's what, you know, differentiates the people from, you know, they're trying to help people than people who are, you know, the thrill seekers or other things.
And again, I don't want to be preaching and tell people, you know, you can't investigate unless you do this or that. But I do, I plead with people, if you are doing it for funsies or the thrill or whatever, just be honest and disclose that up front. Be up front with that. I have a couple of friends who are on teams that they will admit they're non-scientific. They're true believers and they take things at face value. But they admit that. They don't call themselves scientific. They don't present anything as scientific evidence or even proof. I'm fine with that. As long as people are fully disclosing that and being honest, I don't have a problem.
The problem is, I think too many aren't honest with themselves of what their motivations are, really.
Yeah, and that's what kind of prompted me to write the skeptic article, because I had some people that I knew personally who call themselves science-based, and, you know, kind of gave me a bad time when I presented, hey, here's an interesting article about optical illusions, and this could explain a lot of things when, you know, when we hear people say, oh, I know what I saw, I know it had to be a ghost because I know what I saw, and then you look at some interesting evidence or information from neuroscientists who are doing all sorts of experiments with optical illusions, and you're just presenting it. You're not saying this explains everything. You're not bashing anybody. You're just saying, hey, look at this stuff. Here's some information. And then you kind of get razzed, like, well, why do you even bother investigating or writing about this if you're going to dismiss everything? It's like, well, wait a minute. Then why do you call yourself science-based?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So again, I do think... I don't want to preach and tell people what to do. I just hopefully people, if they read my book, they'll approach investigating from a more, inject a little bit more critical thinking. They'll take their client into consideration. And just be able to recognize that we all have our own biases. You know, I carry my bias when I walk into a location, and I have to accept that and recognize that and try to be objective as possible.
This really should be, I don't say this too often, but this is like, I'm saying this honestly, that this is something that I would probably recommend to everybody in the field, no matter what level you are, because for some people it'll be humbling, for other people it'll be enlightening, because you're saying everything in the book that probably is left unsaid to a lot of people, and it's all like nice, neatly wrapped up, packaged in one book, in one section. It covers all the different kind of pitfalls that you can make in this field, and some people may not even be realizing that they're doing it. I give some people the benefit of the doubt. They don't realize because they're just copying what they've learned from who they learned it from and not realizing that. But I think this should be like a must read for
anyone
in the field.
Anybody, right. But also, I mean, let's just say I was guilty of something in that book.
You're probably guilty of a lot of things.
All of the things.
But, I'm guilty of pretty much everything. So.
But, I mean, and let's just say, you know, you came to me and said, well, you know, and tried to explain to me, you know, what Carolyn's explaining in her book. I may take that, be defensive or whatever. Well, if somebody's, if they're reading it,
right,
they can just take it in.
That's a good point, because it's some people, it's corrective criticism when it's coming from someone you know. But if you're reading it in a book, it's not like you, Carolyn pre-planned you to have this book so she can criticize you. You know, it's obviously. Exactly. Well, that would be like some sort of crazy. If that would be true, then the Mayans really are right, and then we're all in trouble.
So many in trouble.
Well, you know, and I also say a lot of people want paranormal unity, and they misunderstand that. Sometimes they think, well, peer review means we all go, hey, good catch, you know, nice shot, good picture. And that's really not what it is. If you put your evidence out there and you call it evidence, you really need to be prepared that people are going to rip it apart. And this is actually part of peer review in science, and it's actually welcomed in science because, you know, the more we can weed out false assumptions, then the easier you get to the truth. Now, having said that, yes, there are people who have absolutely, you know, no tact at all. And they go into name-calling mode and that type of thing, and they trash teams. And that's just not productive. What I've tried to do is approach the person privately through email. I don't have to post on your wall, on their wall, to make myself look like a smarty pants.
Right.
I just tried to contact them directly and say, look, this kind of looks very similar to, you know, the thousands of bats that I've taken. I don't think it's a ghost. It looks like a bat to me. And explain to them about slow shutter speed and low light condition and that type of thing. And most of the time, overwhelmingly, people are receptive. You know, they may still not agree with me, but at least they're more receptive to listening to you.
Right, because you're not calling them out in a public forum to make them look silly.
Yeah.
And there's just the right or wrong way to do it. And unfortunately, that, you know.
Her and Gary Golka should be, that'd be interesting.
That would be interesting.
And that's why I did mention, yes, there is fraud, but there's also people who I kind of coined the term fraud squads that are just bashing people just for the sake of bashing, and I don't think that gets us anywhere either.
No, it doesn't.
It just creates more drama.
Paradrama. Times of paradrama. Well, Carolyn, I thank you very much for coming on tonight.
Thank you,
Carolyn. The name of the book is Carolyn's Creepy Corners, Searching for the Truth in Paranormal Claims. I assume it's available through all the normal book channels, like Amazon and all that.
It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. If you go to my site, which is carolinscreepycorner.blogspot.com, you can see a link there. And
Do you have anything coming up in the future?
Right now I'm hibernating for the winter.
I like that.
I have some creative writing projects that I'm working, my own stuff, and I'm helping others edit some stuff. And
planning a trip to South Jersey.
I'm sorry?
I said, and planning a trip to South Jersey soon.
I am planning that, you know, when the weather
gets nice.
When spring comes, we see that first robin, I'm going to go down there. So
awesome.
Thank you again for coming on.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.